Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome to Teach Me to Talk with Laura and Kate. I'm Laura Mize, pediatric speech and language pathologist.
And I'm Kate Hensler, developmental interventionist with the First Steps program here in Louisville, Kentucky. How are you doing, Laura?
Oh, what a day! But I'm doing great. What a week! We can't have Thursdays without a little drama to keep us on our toes, huh?
I'm afraid that might be right.
Next week is not going to be this way, but anyway. Today is Thursday, September 10th, and if you're listening at 2 o'clock Eastern Time, you're listening live, and we'd like to welcome you to the show. And we are going to pick up where we left off last week with talking about intelligibility, and which means how easy it is to understand your toddler when he or she talks to you. And last week we started really talking about specific sounds and how we elicit those or help children learn how to say those sounds in words. So we're going to continue that discussion today. And again, we're framing all of this within the big topic of talking about children and especially toddlers who have apraxia, which is a neurological speech disorder. Or phonological disorder, which is kind of like the sound version of a language disorder or language delay. And it, again, because the language is messed up, the sounds are messed up. So again, that kind of reframes or explains why we're talking about this, and we've been talking about this for several weeks now. And if you haven't listened before, I have a website called teachmetotalk.com and have put out a set of DVDs for parents, and this newest one that's on sale now is Teach Me to Talk with Apraxia and Phonological Disorders, and for demonstrations of all the techniques we've been talking about in the last few weeks and in the next couple of weeks, be sure to check that DVD out because you'll get to see those techniques in action.
Which I have yet to do, and I'm looking forward to it.
Well, watch if our lives DVD. Will calm down for more than an hour or two, maybe you'll get to see that.
This weekend, I will be watching it because I know I use so many of your techniques, but I'm sure there are things that I don't use currently, but I will be putting into my daily routine with kids I work with. So,
well, I have gotten some feedback from some of the moms of the kids that are in the DVD, and they, like children that have turned three since the time, either shortly before we filmed, shortly after we filmed, or in the coming months, you know, because the last time we filmed for that was in December. So quite a few of those children were turning three or turned three right after that, and I've gotten some sweet notes from the moms this week. And one mom who is just a super mom and did so much research about apraxia and kind of had diagnosed her child even before I saw him, and, you know, once again, I was the replacement speech therapist. And she sent me a note and said, just when I feel like I've got all this speech stuff mastered, you come up and teach me a few new tricks. So, you know, thanks for the DVD. It got me back on track and gave me some new things to try. So I thought that was really nice.
Aww.
And it is good to just kind of refresh your memory sometimes.
Right.
Even when you do it every day, you know, see how another therapist does it or, you know, just get some new ideas. So, again, I think that's why the DVDs have been successful with parents and even with therapists, because you just get to see how somebody else does it. It's not always as easy to read it and put it in practice, I think, as it is to see it and put it in practice. So,
right. And a lot of times for me, I think, well, I do that, but, you know, if I could sum up what I fail to do most consistently that you do so consistently is to be really, 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 really persistent with what you're doing.
Yeah.
And that's always good for me to see it, and I think, well, if Lark can, you know, cue him five times, then I can cue him five times, and it just reminds me to keep it up, so.
Yeah. You know, I did a co-treat yesterday with a little girl, and we've already talked about this, or I guess Tuesday, or yesterday, maybe Wednesday. I don't remember what day it was. But anyway, I worked with one of the OTs on her team, and that's what she said, too. She said, I might cue her, but I only try it one time. And this is a little girl who's got no, 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 no down pat. And that's what kind of almost is her default, is no. And so that I know. Gosh. She's darling, but boy, does she have a personality. And she, that really made that therapist who hasn't practiced in a while, who's just kind of come back to working with children. She used to be a service coordinator. Now she's working with children again. And it really made her reluctant to push her because she didn't feel like she wanted, you know, she wanted to acknowledge that word, first of all, and give the child a little bit of control. But I think this is a situation where this little girl has kind of gone overboard, and that's all she does all day long is kind of control what's going on. And so I was so glad she got to be there in the session and watch how well she performed. And she didn't fall apart. The little girl didn't, and she didn't get up and run around, and she stayed with me and played, but I was that pleasantly persistent and kind of kept going and going and going. And it was a pretty successful session. And so I was glad that her OT got to see that too and know, okay, you really can get more than no, no, no. You know, and a lot of times I'll go, yes, yes, no, we're going to play, come on. Or I really start with choices. And if they say no to one choice, you know, I just keep giving them. And, you know, we might sit there and do 15 different choices, and I'll even go back to things that we did earlier until they finally break down and pick one, because I think they think, good Lord, gee, how long can this lady keep this up?
And we've talked about, Laura, with apraxic kids. You know, we are really kind of asking them to do something that's really hard for them, to use the word to, you know, label or request what they want. And sometimes they do have some personalities to go along with that. They kind of, you know, when you go in and you're trying to get them to do something that's hard, they look kind of somewhat negative behavior sometimes. And those can be pretty effective with some people, you know, with sometimes parents or other caregivers or, and so they kind of learn, oh, yeah, that works. But if you resist that in a playful way,
right,
it also kind of gives them the confidence to know, okay, it's okay how it comes out, and she's going to give it to me. You know, they learn the routine, and so.
Right.
But it can be a little intimidating initially to push those kids, you know.
It can, because you think, okay, I don't want to lose her altogether. But my point with this little girl is, we're not going to get anything but no if we stick to kind of what she's used to and what she's done. One, because she's used to kind of controlling the show, and two, no is her default. And so she goes to that, you know, her little default word, she goes to that almost automatically, even when she doesn't really mean it sometimes, I think. I think it just pops out. You know, that's something she can say.
No is her duh.
It is. No is her duh. Her duh.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So anyway, that was interesting. So I was glad I got to work with that therapist, and then the mom, too, was pretty receptive. So I was excited about that. Anyway, all right, let's pick up. Were you going to say something else?
No.
Okay.
I'm with you.
Okay, well, when we're talking about working on specific sounds, and again, some of this will be a little bit of a review from last week, but I got such, this is the other thing, I got such nice emails from a speech pathologist this week who said, thank you so much for giving out those specific strategies that you're doing on the show right now with apraxia. We can't really find information about working with toddlers. So much of the apraxia literature is really for older children. You know, so this is good to kind of see the whole toddler avenue for treatment. And another person really liked the Sound Cues article with all the different ideas for how to get those specific sounds. And again, that's at my website at teachmetotalk.com. And the articles that you want to look for are called Early Speech Sound Cues. And then I think there's another one called Speech Sound Development that'll tell you when certain sounds are usually produced by most children. And then I have another kind of little cheat sheet that I haven't posted yet, but it's going to be called Consonant Sound Cues. And again, just a little sheet that a parent or a therapist might want to print off, that I'm going to make it more like a chart that has the specific consonant sound, the little sound name that we call it, because you don't say with a two-year-old, let me hear your P. You've got to call it something that means something to them, and then maybe some other little tricks or other little cues for how to get that sound. And I think that'll be helpful. And we actually got a sheet really similar to that several years ago. I guess it's been about 10 years now, Kate, since we saw David Hammer. Has it been that long, maybe? I don't know. Let's see. Are you there? Kate? I will. I'm just going to talk until she's here. Now she's here. Are you there?
I've been hearing you. You
Yay.
Couldn't hear me? Okay.
I couldn't hear you at all. No.
Okay.
But I guess it's been, what, 8 or 10 years since we saw David Hamer and got that great chart from
right.
him. Yeah. And so I kind of redid it and put my spin on it with what I call, because some of the sounds, some of those little names of sounds, I don't really use his anymore. I guess it just morphed over time or picked up an idea here or there, or because of different children would think, that works better. So I'll have that little chart on the website, too. And I know therapists will want to check that out. All right, but let's back up just a bit. And, you know, last week we started talking about these sounds and spent a lot of time talking about them, but I just want to reiterate two things to kind of get us started. First of all, we don't really focus specifically on articulation or intelligibility as the primary activity for therapy, as the main goal with getting sounds in the right places until a child's language age is closer to normal. So if you have a 2.5-year-old that's still struggling to do lots and lots of single words, you're really not going to care if he says duh for more. You're going to try to get it, and you're going to try to, you know, use the cues that we're talking about, but more important than anything is that he try and that he begin to talk. You're not really going to care if he's still saying die-die for a bye-bye if he only has 15 words. You know, you want to only get this picky about speech sounds and really, again, not have this as your primary focus until a child's language is closer to, you know, his vocabulary size is closer to what other children his own age are doing, until he's really, really interacting, he really understands everything. You know, this stuff that we're talking about now is kind of icing on the cake for toddlers. It should not be the primary focus for therapy. You know, and I think when you watch the Apraxia DVD, it's going to look like that's all I do with kids in the course of an hour, because that's the focus of the DVD, but really this is stuff that's mingled in with all the other things that you're doing to interact and to cue language. And I wouldn't even do this kind of thing with a kid that comprehension or interaction were still their main issues. So I wanted to reiterate that. And then secondly, something we talked about last week, when we're cueing these new words and new sounds, we really try to get the sound in a word first. We don't start at the sound level and then move to syllables and then move to words. We start with words and kind of work our way backwards. So if a kid can get a sound in a word, that's what you want to go with. You don't want to say, okay, I'm going to teach him how to say in today. You know, if that were my goal, and words that started with an N at the beginning, I would start with doing words like that, not at the beginning with teaching the sound. So I think we talked about that a little bit last week, but I just want to make sure that we reiterate that, because I think that's an important point. Don't
right.
you, Kate?
Yeah. I wonder, Laura, I want to ask you, though. You talked about you wouldn't do these sorts of things, targeting specific sounds, until the language was at or near age level. But do you mean, you said, like
I wouldn't make it the
words.
Primary focus.
Okay.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I wouldn't make it the primary. I would still do it, but in my mind, I'm not thinking, okay, it's a do or die get an M today on
right.
more.
Okay.
I'm still thinking, okay, I'm going to take his sign. I'm going to take his word. Yeah, I'm going to squeeze in this, you know, get your lips together. Where's your motor sound? Or where's your good sound? I'm going to squeeze that in. But I, you know, really, my goal is getting the word and getting the communication, not necessarily working for 20 minutes on that M.
Right.
You know, we might try it 20 times in the course of an hour, but we're going to be playing and we're going to be doing things. It's not going to be me just wearing the poor little kid down for, you know, 20 minutes on one sound. That would never be my
right.
primary focus. Does that
well,
make
how
sense?
About if, yeah, but how about way? If he didn't have phrases? Say he's, you know, 27 months and he has 20 words, a lot of the sounds are off. Would you target trying to get him to use two-word phrases before you would get
yes.
six? Yeah, I would too.
You know I would.
Yeah, I know, but I wanted you to say
yeah.
it so that people heard
yeah.
that.
Mm-hmm. I totally
part of the
would.
Language packages, if he only
yeah.
has single words and he's over two, well then, you know, it would be more relevant for him to say more cookies, even if it's mo caca. You know?
Yeah, or more tutu.
Yeah.
Or, you know, duh tutu, you know, way off. I'd
mm-hmm.
still rather get those two-word phrases and, again, move closer to that language, you know, have him closer to an age-appropriate language level, and then kind of back up and work on sounds. And, you know, we've talked about this a lot when we look at a kid. First, we look at interaction. If interaction is not fine, that's where we start. If interaction is fine, then we look at a kid's comprehension. If his comprehension is fine, then we look at his language. You know, what signs is he using? What words is he using? At what level is he using those words? Then, only then, would you really think a lot about sounds. And again, I might do this with a kid that, you know, only had 15 or 20 words, and I might be prompting with this, especially with those really early sounds, the M's, the P's, those things. You know, where's your popper? Put your popper on that. But again, that would be something that I say kind of, again, as icing on the cake or an afterthought, not my primary thing for him. Even if he says, if pop is what I want him to say, and he's saying, I'm still going to be cheering and reacting to him like it was the prettiest word I've ever heard. You know, with or without that P, if he still has less than 35 to 50 words. And if especially if he's got 2 words or 10 words, I am not going to be too darn picky about getting that P. We're just going to be excited that he's communicating and work to increase his expressive vocabulary before we start to do these sounds. So that's why, you know, I really wanted to reiterate this, because, again, you look at the DVD and you think, oh, gosh, you know. I mean, I look at it and think, boy, I sure hope people don't think that I'm just riding these kids for, you know, being really, really picky about articulation. Because when I went to grad school, we didn't even think about working on a kid's articulation until after 3. I mean, we would have really laughed about that and said that's totally inappropriate for a child. You know, cognitively, children, you can't always say, do your tongue like this or move your mouth like this, and them understand really what you're talking about. You know, they might be able to imitate your mouth movements and stuff, but for them to be able to think about, gosh, I have voluntary control like this, and she's correcting what I'm doing, and now I'm going to correct my mouth like that, you know, a lot of even typically developing kids can't do that till closer to 3.
Right. So, and I'm sure with a lot of the kids who are on your DVD with apraxia and phonological disorders, when you saw them earlier on, you weren't doing nearly as much of that, and you were doing those kind of prerequisite things with, you know, the social engagement, the the comprehension, you know, get some single words.
Right.
And so just it is important for people to know, because you're really not that kind of therapist. There are actually some who
are.
Bah, 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 bah. And it's like they don't have one word. What does bah mean?
But, I know, or I'll read somebody's plan, and they'll have an oral motor goal.
Mm-hmm.
Written for a kid who's obviously apraxic. There's no real tone issues or whatever. And they've written this goal, and they're, you know, the goal might say something silly like he's going to lateralize his tongue 10 times. Who cares? You know, you really want to be going for those words and that functional communication, stuff he can actually say and use. And his mom's going to, if you have a 2-year-old who doesn't say mama, and then even if mama isn't quite with an M, they're still going to be happy that he's done that, or still happy that he's able to kind of communicate that even if the sound is off. So we don't want to be so picky with these new talkers that we totally deflate their attempts. And if I see a kid really kind of overreacting to that, I hardly do it at all. You know, I might only use these little sound cues 5 times in an hour. You know, really, really minimally compared to how much we're cueing and prompting signs and words and phrases. So,
and usually when you've established a good, playful, you know, relationship with the child, they tell you, and sometimes with words, sometimes with actions, but one way or another, they convey to you that you're doing too much of that and you turn them off. I mean, you know what I mean? A child who normally loves therapy, loves to play, plays your games, goes along with it. If you push too much and they really aren't ready, they disengage. They throw the Lego at your head. They, you know, they do something to let you know, really, this isn't working for me. And, you know, sometimes
Or they're throwing themselves backwards on the floor.
Really
They suddenly want to go try to turn the TV on, you know, all those kinds of cues. And some therapists might say, no, he's got to do this. He's got to really push through this. And I'm going to make him, and I think that's the wrong approach. You know, I'm at the beginning was talking about being that pleasantly persistent. You know, yeah, I do that, but if I get a lot of resistance, and I'm not talking about like my new sweet little friend who does no, because she's still smiling at me when she's saying that.
Right.
She might put her hands up, but she's not trying to leave me. She's sitting right there. She starts digging in my bag for something new. You know, she obviously wants to continue the interaction. We're talking about when kids have totally turned you off. And again, smacking you in the face would be a real big clue that you have pushed beyond their little limit and you need to move on to something that's more fun. Then you can come back to it. But I've had kids, I have a little girl right now in my caseload that I really, her family's going through so much stress right now and with just all kinds of things happening and going on. And she's just started preschool. And her mom told me, did I talk about this last week? Her mom said, I don't understand. She's just not doing stuff anymore. Every time I try to get her to do some of this stuff, she just falls apart. She starts crying or, you know, she puts her head down or she hides behind me. And I said, oh, gosh, you're doing too much. You know, you mm-hmm. need to take a speech holiday. You need to not cue this, any of this. And that mom is really reluctant to do that because she's pretty intense about this kind of thing. And I've said, you know, that's just too much. This is too much new stuff for her right now, and we've got to read her signals and respect that, and we'll be able to pick it back up in a couple of weeks, but not for right now. And we've had kids, Kate, that we've talked about this before, if I get a kid that's gotten really negative because the mom has kind of overdone this kind of cueing during the week, I'll say, look, I'm not coming back for 2 or 3 weeks. We need a big, fat vacation. And you need to lay off him and do nothing but play and cue words and phrases. And let's kind of go back to that some of that initial stuff that we did and then bring him back so that he's not kind of stuck in that negativity thing. Because you're not going to get anywhere
right.
with a toddler like that. That's different than a 5-year-old or an 8-year-old. You know, you really can't, quote, unquote, win that battle with a toddler. You're just going to make them shut down or regress or be so negative that it's not even worth it. So I, you know, sometimes don't even see kids for a few weeks if they're kind of in that rut. And then we sort of start over, and lo and behold, a month later, we pick it back up and they're able to do it.
Right. And just for clarity's sake, let us say that we love parents who do what we tell them to do, but there are some who do it so much, you know, that
I know.
It is kind of like therapy every waking moment, and we love to have them do our strategies and to, you know, have that structured time when they really are targeting what we're asking them to target and all that. But for some parents, they think, well, if more is good, then all the time would be wonderful, and you can really... I certainly reach points in therapy sessions where I think, okay, he's taken all he can take. And
that's
if
it.
He had that
yeah.
all day, and you know, you think it's like people love to go to the gym, but if you had to go there all day and exercise, that would be horrible.
Yeah.
Well, you know,
oh,
it'd be horrible
yeah.
at all for me, but, you know, for a normal person, they would like it for a short time. But in any case, you know, I'm just saying that I don't want people thinking we're saying that, you know, parents don't do it right. Most parents do it great. And,
oh, yeah.
And
most parents do a great job.
Too well, and we just have to say, back off a little bit, give her a little space, give him a little space, and it gets better very quickly. So
it does. And again, this and that doesn't happen with every kid. You might have a kid. And I think the real reason it's happening with that little girl is because there's so many other stressors
mm-hmm.
going on for that family right now. They're about to move, and she has both of her older brothers have their own special needs, and she just started preschool, and she just got, you know, she's trying to get potty trained, you know, all these things at one time, and mom has some pretty chronic health issues, so it's not just one thing for this little girl, it's, you know, 7 things, so I think that's another reason she's seeing it. It's like, I can't take it anymore, you know, the straw that broke the camel's back, so... Be aware of that, and if you see that happening, if you're a therapist in sessions with kids, back off, work on language, you know, work on higher-level comprehension stuff, you know, do some different stuff. Give them a little break, because then you don't ever want to lose them as far as them not wanting to interact and play with you, and I'd much rather take it easy on all this articulation stuff than create a problem that it's going to take weeks to undo.
Right. And like you said earlier, also, it's very child-specific. One child tolerates
yeah.
it pretty well. Another child, it's you know, touchy, and you have to be very sensitive to what they will tolerate. And just depends on the child. When I get those kids who are very tolerant, I always feel a little guilty, like, he'll just let me push him and push him and push him. You know, I feel like, oh, I'm really pushing them too hard. But like I said earlier, they do let you know. So, you know,
right,
just be aware of what they're telling you, whether it be through their actions or their words, and respond to it. So.
Right. Right.
Okay.
Okay. The general guidelines that I talk to parents about is when we first start talking about this, and again, developmentally, kids are usually between 2.5 and 3 cognitively or developmentally before we start doing a lot of this, is before then, you know, eye contact is important and interaction is so important, but I haven't really stressed before this point with parents about really getting children to look at them. You and I have talked about before, Kate, that we sometimes think eye contact is a little bit overrated for some kids, you know, who are you know, they've their comprehension, they end up kind of doing what you ask them to do, but you're not saying, look at me, you know, over and over and over, like some parents kind of wear that out. But for a child that you're really starting to focus on articulation and intelligibility, you do want them looking at your face with so that they can get some feedback from you visually, you know, with what your mouth is doing. Sometimes if I feel like, you know, a kid is so busy with playing that he's not really understood what I want him to do when I'm cueing a sound, I might take his hands as I'm saying, look at me, and put them on my face or put them on my throat. And that is usually something that their parents haven't done. So it makes it a little bit novel, and they like that, and that's a way to get them to look at me. And again, this would not be for a kid that for whom eye contact was a real challenge, like a child on the spectrum. You know, we wouldn't be using that kind of cue for him. I'm talking about for children that are pretty, you know, language is moving along, all this other stuff is moving along, you're going to work on sounds, you just want them to be able to get some, to see your mouth and how it moves. So sometimes I use that little hint of putting their hands on my face. Other times you're going to use gestures as visual cues, like if I have a child who's maybe working on that dreaded long E vowel, you know, I really want them looking at my mouth, and I'm pointing at my mouth and doing my fingers. You know, I might hold them right in front of my thumb and my index finger right in front of my mouth and spread them apart, you know, like I'm saying E with my fingers too. When kids are trying to do W's or O's or H's and they're not rounding their lips, you know, I've got my little index finger in front of my mouth, you know, making my circle there, you know, for kids who can't do, who are doing for open, I'm going, no, open, open, look, 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 and I'm using the visual cue of having my finger right there, you know, drawing little imaginary circles around my mouth. So you want to use those kinds of visual cues. Again, we're going to use verbal cues, meaning that we're going to tell them how to make the sound. And with toddlers, we do that by calling sounds. We don't really call them their alphabetical name. We give them a sound name that kind of fits with the production properties or how you say that sound. Like for peas, we talked about last week, we call popper sounds. Kate, jump in with any. I think you might have some different names for these sounds than what I do. Let's just kind of zip down the list, and if you have a better idea or a different name that, excuse me, that works well with kids, jump right in there. And let me say, too, that sometimes I adjust the name of what we call a sound based on words that a kid has. If a kid has, you know, like last week we talked about my friend Max, M was his Max sound because we worked on that forever. So jump in here if you want to kind of talk about those. But B's, as in boy, I call that the big popper sound, and it's so great that big starts with B. So I've got that there. And big is a word that I usually target all the time with kids anyway. I think that's kind of a fun word to work mm-hmm. on. And then the cue that I might do for that, the other visual cue, is just putting my finger right to my lips when I'm doing pah or bah so that they can see that my lips are together. M is that related to sound, and we talked about these last week. You know, I call that the mm-mm good sound, or the David Hammer calls it the motor sound or the humming sound. With my new little friend on Tuesday, I started calling her M, her mama sound, because she's got a great mama. That's about the only M she has. So she kind of got that. That made sense to her. And if a child is having a lot of difficulty getting his lips together, I might take my index finger and put it above his top lip and my thumb and put it below his bottom lip and smush those little lips together. And again, I'm kind of sensitive about a child's particular aversions. If he is tactile defensive and doesn't like for me to touch him, you know, I'm not going to just dive right in there and do that 50 times in a session. I'm pretty leery about touching little mouths, especially in the beginning, because it is such a turnoff to a lot of kids.
I have found with a lot of kids, though, that if you have them touch you first,
yeah,
it's like that's novel and they like it, and then it
they
seems
do.
Like they're a little bit more tolerant of you touching them if they've been allowed to, you know, touch your cheeks, or I wouldn't necessarily put their fingers by my mouth, but I might put their hands up by my mouth as I was doing, you
yeah.
know. So they seem to, like, a lot of them anyway seem to get that. If you let them touch you, then it kind of reduces their resistance to you touching them.
Right, and that a lot of times is so much easier for mommies to do because you're kissing those little lips anyway and wiping those noses and drinking after them, and so that's not probably as they wouldn't be as squeamish about that as maybe you or I with our little host of little friends in the germ pools that we see all the time. But I do get little fingers in my mouth a lot of times when they're trying to make me do that sound. That's kind of fun, too, if you have a kid that's really, really cognitively with it, and you say, oh, I can't do it, help me. Max did that a lot with my lips. You know, he would try to push my lips together, and he thought that was lots of fun.
I bet he did. You know, Laura, I want to interject when you were talking about putting his hands on your face to try and encourage him to look at you. The other thing that I know you do all day long, just as I do, is to hold the toy right up by your face so that,
yeah,
you know, if you have the ball or you have the truck or you have whatever it is that you know darn well he wants, then if you hold it up right by your face, it's not as obvious or kind of, you know, directive as saying,
right,
look at me, you know. And I always
right.
kind of feel, again, a little guilty because we're holding the ball, we're holding the truck, and really all they want to do for the most part is play with it. And sometimes it's easy to lose them on the floor. They want to play with whatever they have, or, you know, fight you for what you have. And here we're trying to get them to look at us. And of course, one thing we are is right down there on the floor so that they have
right.
a better shot at actually looking at our mouths. And I know I kind of tall, so I, you know, kind of scrunch down a lot. But the other
yeah.
little trick that you just didn't list on here, and I know we've talked about it in the past, is to just get that object that you know they want, whether
right.
it's the Teddy Graham or the ball, right by your face. So that really what he wants to see is the ball or the Teddy Graham he wants, but he's kind of forced to see your mouth. And, of course, you're going to do it in a pretty exaggerated way. So,
right.
you know, he'll be thinking, why is she going, with her mouth just because she's holding that Teddy Graham right there. So, anyway, I just thought I'd put that in there because we didn't state it. And I think that a lot of times that is a really effective thing to do to get him to look at your face.
It is, and you can experiment with your own child as to where that's most effective. Sometimes it's right beside your face. Sometimes it's right under your mouth. You
mm-hmm.
think, boy, right in front of my chin is where they're going to look at it more. It's funny. You can kind of move the toy around and, you know, see your kid track and then
mm-hmm.
kind of get visually track where it is and then kind of get, oh, yeah, that's when he's looking at my mouth is when I hold it right here.
That's a sweet spot, yeah.
Yeah. So that's a good idea. I did want to talk about, there's a whole therapy approach called PROMPT that lots of clinicians really swear by and lots of moms do too. And PROMPT is a whole cueing system. It's specialized. It takes specialized training to do it. Speech pathologists have to go to like 3 different levels of training and even be filmed doing this particular approach with children. And it's very hands-on and doing lots of hand movements right with the child's mouth. And I think for an older child who's not making progress any other way, PROMPT might be an avenue that I would recommend for a parent to explore. They've worked with the research sites about children with lots of low tone issues, but also children that have motor planning issues or are apraxic. So again, that would not be my first line of treatment approach for a toddler, because I believe that all of our approaches with toddlers and in early intervention should be grounded in play and in playfulness. And we have so many children in early intervention that are so reluctant for someone else to touch their mouths. And so for a lot of children, I think that prompt is never something that I would do kind of when they're young and still really struggling with language delay. So you would, but you might say that. I'm not saying I'm totally opposed to prompt either. So, again, kind of I just wanted to put that in there. Lots of moms, I swear by that, and say there's no way my kid will learn how to talk if I didn't have a prompt trained therapist. So you'll find some really divisive opinions about that method.
And I have heard of it, but honestly, in 10 years, I can say I haven't been on a team with a prompt trained therapist I've been on a team with a few who were prompt trained. They did not have much success with the kids we shared because they weren't really playful enough, and they
right.
really tried to go right in there and do all that. And these kids were like, no way, you know.
Yeah, I do not like you to put your hands on my mouth. Yeah.
That's right. You know, it really wasn't. And I could see where with a little bit older child, a 5-year-old or a 7-year-old or a 10-year-old, they're going to be much more responsive to that and really kind of understand the concept of why does that lady touch me like that? What does...
Right.
And a 2-year-old just really doesn't get it cognitively. Even the smartest 2-year-old in the world doesn't
right.
really get. Why is that therapist all over me like that and not
right.
keeping it playful and fun? They just shut you right down. So
they totally do. And then you lose them all together. And, you know, again, not worth it to me. I'd
mm-hmm.
rather back up and play and really work on language and save all this sound stuff for when they are a little older and do understand it a little bit better. But you'll see me in the Apraxia DVD really touching a lot of little faces, and I think, gosh, you know, if you just look at that and without thinking about all the other things and kind of hearing me talk about it, you would think that I do that probably a lot more than I really do. So, again,
but those are kids
of,
who were prepared and ready for that kind of therapy.
And who knew me really well
right.
and loved me already. So
right. You had done the groundwork to get them there to tolerate it. And if you had
right.
just gone in and done that, there would be no DVD because you couldn't get a kid to stay there and play with
yeah.
you long enough to film it.
Or a mom who would say, no way, we're not signing up for any more of that. Thank you very
yeah.
much. I'm not
yeah,
going to see
putting
my
kid throwing a fit on a DVD. Yeah.
yeah.
So anyway, I understand totally what you're saying because I know what you do most often, and it's not so much of that. But with those kids,
right.
they were ready for that.
Right. Okay, let's finish running down this list. N is a lot of times I'll just do the sound, or I've called it the Nana sound with a little friend of mine who's on the DVD because Nana was a word, like banana was a word that he could really say. Again, with my new little friend on Wednesday, the no-no kid, boy, N is going to be her no-no sound because, boy, does she have that word down pat. The trick that I do for getting kids to do an N is to what speech pathologists would say, dentalize it, meaning that I'm going to put my tongue up where they can see it kind of under my top teeth. Na, 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 na. And again, that's not the really correct way to do an N, but boy, when they can see you put your tongue there, it gives them a better idea of what they should do with their tongues too. So the other thing that I talk about is, you know, ooh, feel it wiggle, feel it shake. You know, because N is a nasal sound, and you're going to feel that vibration when you do that. And that's kind of a cool way to get toddlers to do that. And, again, that's something, a sound where they might really want to put their little hands on your face to feel that. So that's a good way to do it. I did want to mention a lot of therapists use a mirror when they're doing this kind of sound work. I really don't because I think it's distracting for kids. And I think sometimes those poor little apraxic kids with motor planning problems get even more confused when they're trying to look in the mirror and do it. So
I've tried the mirror thing. I will say I have one right now who I'm doing a lot of this with because her language has come along at warp speed. But I see her in this great daycare, and there's a mirror on the wall, and we sit at this little table that is child-sized, you know, so it's perfect kind of therapy environment. And she does great, but when I've tried, like, a handheld mirror, that was unsuccessful.
Oh, they start breathing all over it.
Yeah.
And unless you're working on H's. Now, if you're working on a, that's a great, you know, I'll use a mirror. More often than that, though, I'll use a window or
yeah.
a door with glass. But I don't know. Sometimes I think we just get totally distracted with the mirror, mm-hmm. and I just don't have as good a luck with that. But some therapists kind of swear by that.
I could see it with an older child. You know, you're going to lose a little one with that. This kid does, because we're sitting there anyway.
Right.
And I'll point it out, and she can see me in the mirror, and I can see her in the mirror. And she's not great about watching my mouth, so she seems to attend to the mirror a little better, but she's the first, and it just happened to be on the wall, and it was like, hey, that worked for her. But,
well, and it's part of her routine, too,
right.
if it's already on the wall. It's not something that's novel, and I think that's what happens. I would bring out a mirror, and
mm-hmm.
that's something we haven't done before, and so then it, you know, kind of takes a while to get back to what you were trying to do, which is fine. You know, that might be a good distraction on some days for some kids, but I don't know. I just don't have as much luck with that.
Right.
A T, I call a tongue tapper. A tippy sound is what David Hamer calls that, because you're making that sound with the tip of your tongue. The other little cue that I use with that is to put a finger above your upper lip and kind of under your nose, because that's, you want the kids to get the idea, oh, I lift my tongue up, you know, inside my mouth, right to that spot. A D, again, because it's the voice version of T, I would call that the big tongue tapper sound or the tippy sound, and same thing, finger under your nose.
You alluded to this on whoever that child is. You called it the mama sound. A lot of kids I see initially, they might have a couple words, and dada is frequently one of them. I have called it that, too. It's
me
like
too.
Pick the one word they can say with that sound, and if that's particularly the only time you hear that sound, that does seem to kind of get them, you know.
It does.
Help them understand what you're talking about.
It doesn't. My little friend Max could say Diego. He could say dada, but when I did...
Diego! Ooh, that's a good one.
Well, he called him O for a long time, then E-O, and then E-A-O, and then we finally got a D a year later. But, you know, he could do a D in that. He couldn't do a D in the word down. He couldn't do a D for dog. Mm. So, you know, once we got Diego, we were able to get some other D words because of that cue. So, again, sometimes those, it's finding the right cue for it and the right word for it, and it's like it clicks, and they think, oh, I can do that. We talked about H. I usually call that my breathy sound. The way to get that, you know, that you put your open palm in front of your mouth to hear your and I almost, with kids who can't do an H, in a word, if we're working on H, get in front of a glass door or window where that they can see you make your little cloud, is what I call it, and, you know, you're making your H right there so that they can do that. I've called it my doggy sound, too, for kids who can do like a pant,
mm-hmm.
and that's been a good one for one of my other little friends right now. She can do an H with that. But she's a little girl who, oh, my goodness, has taken H and done it with everything, so I don't know.
Oh, no, not that one.
That's
one
of those.
Huh?
Yeah. Two of them did better this week, though. I'll have to give you that report later, but two of them did a lot better with that this week. But that might be a thing, too. Again, you're just going to kind of pick a cue that lets your child, something that your child can do and would be easy to associate that with.
I'm sorry, Laura. I usually do, I have stuck kind of with the windy sound, and it seems like a lot of kids really benefit if I'll take their hand and put it in front of my mouth.
Yeah.
And do it, make it windy, and I do it, and then I think, oh, where's your windy sound? Like, once they feel mine, they kind of get the concept, oh, she's puffing over there, and they can do it. That's one they really seem to benefit from. Let them feel yours, then I'll either hold their hand up in front of their mouths or kind of put my hand behind theirs and help them, you know, hold it up from their mouths. And they usually get that one pretty well.
They do. Yeah, mm-hmm. it is. That's a good one. W's, David Hamer calls it the slidey sound because you're going from ooh to E for ooh, wah, or wee is usually the one that I practice with that, the W. But I've had a lot of children who can't round their lips when they're
mm-hmm.
doing that. So that's the cue that I use a lot for I want. because that's a phrase, you know, that you're going to practice a lot. I want candy. I want ball. And telling kids, round your lips, round your lips. And, you know, again, doing my little circle around my mouth. And, again, the reason the W, you're rounding right there, is because the vowel that comes after that for want, and your N is right there, kind of, you know, that nasal sound in the middle of your mouth, too. So you really don't want them sliding to that E at that point. So it, you got to kind of watch how you use the Q. A K and a G are your throaty sounds, and it's so effective to call those your throaty sound and then touch your neck or your throat back there, you know, with a k, k, k. A lot of times I will get a kid, though, who at two just cannot do that sound, and then all of a sudden, a week or two before they turn three, they're able to do it, and I think, oh, thank you, God, for maturation. That finally kicked in. because some kids really don't get those back consonants until close to three. S, I always call a snake sound, and you can cue kids to smile with your teeth together. One other trick I use is taking my index finger and kind of sliding it up my arm for a kid who might do a T for an S. So that sliding your index finger up your arm like it's a snake really kind of lets them know, oh, that sound keeps going. It's not just a T, it's a S. And I think snakes are kind of fun to talk about with two-year-olds. They usually get a big kick out of the whole snake sound thing.
Absolutely. That's the biggie.
Yeah. S is so important, too. A lot of therapists really might not work on that with a two-year-old, but so much language information is carried with an S or a Z, which is the, you know, voice version of that. You know, we grammatically, we make words plural or more than one with an S. At the end, we make words possessive with an S, and those are language concepts, plurals and possessives, that come in when a child is 2.5 to 3. So, again, I think S is a pretty darn important sound for that reason, and so I do go ahead and work on that, but there might be other therapists who would think, oh, gosh, don't work on an S with a 2-year-old, but I think it's one that I usually get pretty good success with
kids. And, again, like you stated before, practice kids tend to break the rules. So, hey, you may have a kid who can do the S, forget the B and the P, but they've got the S. Yeah. I do some S's, definitely.
I do, too, especially at the end, especially final S. Z, call, of course, the zippy sound, because I'm having kids zip those darn Ziploc bags, 10 times in a session, and we were laughing about how many kids we have that say zip as one of their first words. That's just nature of who their therapists are.
I had an Arabic mother a year or so ago, and her little girl, one of her first words was zip. And at some point, she was very sweet and nice, but at one point, she started laughing when their little girl said zip. And I said, what's so funny? And she said, in Arabic, that means a bad word.
Oh, that's funny.
I didn't know. She says, I only let her say it with you.
That's funny. Nobody's ever told me that before.
I was saving it for this topic. No, it is true. I thought, I didn't know that. Yeah. So anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one that if you have a kid that has a pretty good S, you know, Z, you might be able to get that in again, because we're doing it zip, you know, again, that makes it a little more fun for a kid to want to do it. If a kid can't get the Z except in zip, who cares? It's not a letter that, you know,
really,
even occurs
they use
very
all that
frequently.
Much. Yeah.
Yeah, you will, you know, most of the time if you're doing plurals, sometimes that S at the end of a word really is technically more a Z, but again, with a 2-year-old, who cares? So that Q is on there. F is the bitey sound, and, you know, you're going to tell a kid, bite your lip, bite your bottom lip, put your teeth down here, and get them to do an F or a V. F, I do end up working on. Again, a lot of times with kids, like with off, if I have a kid who's just learning how to do finals, we might stick an F on the end of that, but that's kind of a later developing sound, too. That doesn't usually come in with some kids until between 3 and 4, so it's something I might cue but not really care if a kid gets or not. The next one is SH, and again, that's a later sound, too, but it's so effective with kids because you can call it your be quiet sound and do a lot of shh, shh. You know, we've talked about playing with night-night with baby dolls and with animals and even with Thomas. I make Thomas the train and his little friends go night-night. So I call that the be quiet sound. I almost always have kids put their fingers up in front of their lips. If they're not puckering those little lips out to get a good shh, you know, that's something you can make them do with your hand. Reach up and grab those little mouths and pucker those lips out. But that's one that really, I think it's pretty easy to get. And then I think it's easy to cue that because, like, with the word like push, you know, you can bring your own finger up to your lips and get that sound on the end of that. And sometimes I had kids be able to get that final sound, that SH, in for push and fish long before they get something easier like pop. So, again, you know, with a P, so go figure, you know, try all these different sounds to see what you get. I know we're going fast, but I want to get through this whole list so we don't have to keep going back to this sound article. So let's just zip through the rest of these sounds. And, again, these are what are technically considered later developing consonants, but your point, Kate, about sometimes apraxic kids really can get sounds that are harder. So if you have a kid that's saying this or almost able to say it or you think, oh, my gosh, I bet he's able to do this, you know, just kind of based on your own intuition or something, just go with it. And, again, it doesn't have to be completely accurate in a word for us to be happy. Just to even be close, you know, would be fine. CH, I call the choo-choo sound because I'm constantly playing with trains and going ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch. And, again, if you've got a kid that can do an SH, he can probably get pretty close on a CH, too. J or a J, David Hammer calls it your chomping sound. Again, you're going to pucker your lips out and have them j-j-j like they're chomping is his word for that. L, I always call the la-la-la sound or the Lara sound. It's amazing how many two-year-olds I see that are able to do an L because my own children really struggled with that sound. It is a sound that kids can see, and if you've got a kid who can do a really good D and a really good N because it's made at the same place in your mouth, chances are you can do an L. David Hammer calls that the tower sound, and he demonstrates where you're putting your tongue up behind your top teeth like it's a tower. And so sometimes a kid can get that. An R, I call a roar sound. Kate, I don't know that you ever really probably target an R, do you?
I don't. Nor do I do an L, to be honest.
Yeah, I hardly do either unless I see that a kid can do that or they kind of do it accidentally and I think, oh, boy, let's get this in other words. He has the best trick for this for an R. It's pushing up both sides of your tongue and then moving your tongue back, and you call it your butterfly tongue. So everybody stop and do that right now.
Now, wait. Say it again. I'm trying, but you lost
okay.
me.
Okay, take your tongue and push it up on both sides, like in the front. Push it up on both sides. Make each side of it touch the top of your mouth, and then pull it back. You feel how with your your tongue on either side is up, and you let a kid look at that with you, and you tell him to make a butterfly, put his wings up. That's a good trick for an R.
Okay, here's my solution. I would say you really do need a speech therapist for that.
An R is just would be the bane of my existence. No way could I be an elementary school speech pathologist. That would drive me nuts. You know,
and
that
R
you get
is late,
an R.
though, isn't it? Like about what is typical age for an R to be, you know, at what point do you become concerned?
Seven or eight. Oh. And Macy, oh, bless her heart, my little girl who's 13 now, I tried to get her qualified for speech for an R every darn year from the time she was in kindergarten because she really just did an which is an okay, that vowel substitution for an R because at least she was getting the sound. That's closer to an R than, say, a W for an R. But
my kids were W for R's.
Yeah. But, you know, the speech pathologist at her elementary school would just roll her eyes every year and go, no way.
Nope. Sorry.
No way. You fix this at home. And then, you know, by third grade, she got it. But I was really concerned about that darn R. So R is something I would never work on. But, you know, I've got a little boy right now who R is a sound he can do really, really well. You know, car, you know, he's got that great R on the end. So, again, we're just going to go with it. He can't do too many T's and D's, but he's got an R. so you're going to go with what a kid can do. And then Y is another really hard sound, too, and that's you're going to do an E to an O. And I practice all that with kids when I'm saying, you do it. No, you do it. But, again, that's hard for a lot of apraxic kids to do because it's kind of two sounds into one for that initial Y. So that little cheat sheet's going to be on the website hopefully this weekend, and there are the other article on there, the early speech sound cues. That will, we talked about that a little bit last week, but that also has a word list, Kate, which was your fantastic suggestion from a couple of weeks ago, with the words that we target to get specific sounds. So if you're having a hard time kind of coming up with words that might be easy for a kid to say with an N or a T, do that. I've also written in some kind of rationale on here about why we work on some sounds and why we don't. Like, you would never, with toddlers or young preschoolers, you would never really work on voiced sounds like your B, your D, and your G at the ends of words, because you're going to end up making them, you know, sound really Italian. Tubba or bunga, because you overemphasize that sound. So I explained some of that in the article, too, so you can kind of end up thinking like a speech therapist on that and knowing why you work on some sounds versus why you wouldn't really want to overwork on some sounds. So that's that. Kate, we've got maybe 4 minutes left, so do you want to reiterate anything? I've got one more thing I think I want to say if you don't have anything to add.
Well, the only thing I want to ask you for my own knowledge, if you were trying to target, you know, trying to get a child, and this may be in there, and I may have read it, but it didn't stick. Say you want a child could say ball, and you said, oh, well, maybe that's not a good example. You've heard very few words, but you're starting on simple words, trying to get him to say anything. Do you generally start with, like, those bilabial sounds, the B's, the P's, in the beginning of the word?
I do, yeah.
I do. I mean, I don't know if there's any real reason I do that other than I kind of think it's easier. I mean, if a child only comes close on a word, you're going to understand, people will understand the word more easily if they have that sound in the front of the word than the back is kind of my
opinion. And lots of kids don't get those sounds at the ends, those final consonants, until two and a half, you know, after two and a half toward three anyway. And it's not really even considered an error for a child not to have a consonant at the end of a word until he's over three. And so while you still want to kind of target it when he's two, because that's when it's coming in with all of his little friends, it's still not, you know, out of the norm not to have that until that third birthday. So I would always start with it at the beginning, unless I kind of heard that a kid was, like my little friend Max is on the DVD, unless I kind of heard him doing some final consonants, and he can't get consonants at the beginning, and then I would think, oh boy, let's just try them at the end. Let's just see how many different ones we can get at the ends of words, since we obviously aren't going to get them at the beginning, and that's when I might kind of shift my focus. But, again, that's so child-specific. I would generally start with it at the beginning.
Too, the ones that stick in my mind as being the most obvious, and it has, you know, because I'm not a trained speech therapist, sometimes it has to be pretty obvious for me to say, oh, I see the trend there. I noticed that. Sometimes kids can get those what we call throaty sounds, the K and the G sound, at the end of a word, but they can't get them at the beginning.
Yeah.
You know, they can say,
and that's pretty common,
bug, but they can't say go.
Right. And that's okay. You know, you're just going to go with what they can do.
Right.
Just go with what they can do. You know, and we talked a lot about consonants today and how important consonants are, but really vowels are what make you more intelligible than anything. If you have a kid that only has an oh my goodness, please, please, please work on emphasizing those vowel sounds and exaggerate your vowels in words, because that does more for helping someone understand what he's saying than even consonants do. And remember, vowel errors are really, that needs to make you really think that a child has apraxia or a motor planning issue, or kids with low muscle tone, like babies with Down syndrome or cerebral palsy really have a harder time with vowels too. So if you have a kid that's doing lots of vowel errors, that should really be a ding, 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 ding. You know, this is either dysarthria, which is associated with muscle tone, or apraxia. Because phonological kids with just a straight phonological disorder or just a language delay or speech delay really don't mess up vowels as often as children with those other two diagnoses. So if you've got a kid that's saying buh for boo, or he tries to say please and he says paw or pa, or, you know, when you notice his A-E-I-O's and U's are messed up, you know, again, that's more serious and you want to work on vowels. The best resource for therapists for working on vowels is Chamberlain and Strode. There, Easy Does It for Apraxia Preschool Edition has a nice section on vowels. And again, they have worksheets and stuff. You're not going to want to do that with a 2 or 3-year-old, but you take the ideas and how they tell you to elicit those vowels and you work that into your play. So that's a good resource. And the Apraxia DVD, let me say one more thing about that today. It has probably, I don't know, it probably has 15 different references at different points in the DVD where I say, oh, and this is a good resource if you want to learn more about this therapy technique. So for therapists, if you're not well-versed in this and you're really thinking I need to expand my knowledge here, you know, the references are all in the DVD, so that would be another good resource for you to have. All right, I think we got through this section on sound strategies. Next week, we're going to start talking about phrases, and again, we kind of did this a little bit out of order. We should probably be working on lots and lots of phrases before we start getting too picky with these sounds, but we'll talk about phrases, and then if we have time, moving on to sentences after that, and that should finish up our series on apraxia.
Sounds great. You're going to have to make a new DVD so we have something else to talk about.
My DVD making days are over for
on
a
while. On hold.
This last one, oh, it was a big project. I need a break. So
well, and if anybody's still listening, let me just say we loved having that caller last week. And if you're out there in the real world living with your child who's apraxic or you suspect he or she may be apraxic, call us because we love calling.
We love mommies. It. We'd love to hear.
Or a therapist. If you're a therapist who's doing this and thinking, that's a revelation, or even, I have a great idea that works with a lot of my kids, call us. We'd love to hear.
Please call us with that. Please. We would love to hear that. That'd be great. All right. We'll talk to you next week. Thanks.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Bye.